You're listening to a case study about translating risk adjustment intel meaningfully to product design, presented by Ed Vazo, CFO of Community Health Options. This session was presented at the February 2017 Risk Adjustment Value Visit.
Okay, so next up, so we have Ed from Community Health Options. So Ed is a CFO with Community Health Options, one of our member organizations, and has been doing some pretty snazzy things with their risk adjustment insights. And I feel like Wakely set you up really well, actually, because they were really, right? In a good way, like in a positive way.
It's kind of funny because it's like Wakely and I wore the same dress, but Wakely is obviously far more attractive than I. So I'm going to put mine on inside out and backwards and see if it helps. You know, yeah. But no, please, everybody pull up the Wakely presentation from this morning right now and have the first three pages ready to go, because I think you're going to see them again. The only difference is theirs is using the vocabulary of an actuary, and mine is using the word bucket of a finance professional. So the goal is explaining it all and highlighting the important parts. And let me just say, I'm not the expert in anything, right? I'm just like everybody else here trying to figure this out, trying to make sense of it, listening and talking to anybody I can, you know, engaging with the great vendors that we have and any expert that will talk to me and trying to put it all together. So my goal here is to very transparently share with this room what I'm thinking, what I'm doing, and in the areas where I'm incomplete or just plain wrong. I know Joe's just, where'd he go? He's probably just waiting for the chance, you know, to let me know. Okay, so yeah, he is. But that's okay, because, you know, the only one, when I go back to Maine, only Jen would know, you know, and that's all, I'll buy her off of something. So explaining it all, highlighting the important parts. Okay. Well, that didn't work. There we go. All right. So here we go. This is the Wakely slide number two, right? So it's the risk adjustment formula. I call it RA401 because, I mean, again, just look at the formula, look at the definitions. It's crazy. Who can make sense of this? And the only value I add was the little tagline, the formula giveth and the formula taketh away. Because it's true, right? That formula can give you, on average, 10% of a QHP issuer's premium changes hands through RA. So you could close out the whole year and you still have 10% of your premium at risk. And as we know, the average margin for an issuer is, what, 2 or 3%? So at the end of the year, you've got 3 years of margin at risk. That's kind of crazy. So let's see. Can we make it a little easier to understand? Again, does this look familiar? Looks a whole lot like what Julian Cron had up here earlier. So, you know, just simplifying it, your transfer payment is some version of your risk-adjusted premium minus your actual premium. It's not actually your actual, but it's pretty close, times your average premium. All right, you've seen that already by smarter people than me. So let's move on. Okay, so, wow, that little lever moves. It didn't move on my computer. I'm serious. I had no idea. It's incredibly distracting, isn't it? So what I've tried to do is put this in simple words, because those are the words that I have in my word bucket, and as opposed to the elvish words that Wakely uses to define their stuff. They're not here, right? I can do that. I can make it good. Somebody will tell on me, but that's okay. So plan liability risk score, everybody focuses on PLRS, but just like Julia said, you know your PLRS and you really don't know anything, even year to year, because so many other things change, but everybody else focuses on it. So let's focus on it here too for a little bit. What's in it? Your demographics, your age is in it, your health conditions and severity. All right. We've talked about health conditions and severity a lot here. Folks have spent entire hours on that, and they do it for a living. They know it better than me. And Wakely touched on age a little bit, age factors. I'm going to go a little deeper into that because just to go back, that ARF on the right side, that's basically your age rating factor. You know, it goes from 1 to 3, or really 0.65 to 3. Notice that's on the right hand that Julian Cron talked about. That's on the bad side of the formula. So changes in age can impact your risk transfer just as much as changes in PLRS. Yeah, we're always focused on PLRS, and we don't think much about age, but it's something to be aware of. Complex arrangements. What else can we do to improve our PLRS? One of the first things everybody's head goes to is, I'm going to make complex arrangements with my providers, and it's got great potential. And I think yesterday a few folks were talking about going out there and trying to contract some risk sharing around, you know, risk transfer with providers. And it sounded like somebody had had some luck with it, but I haven't heard many people share success in this area. I know that we have not had any success in this area at CHO. Can I just ask, has anybody really managed, you know, in this current, can you give us a hint? How do you do it?
Hi, I'm Brian from Sharp Health Plan in San Diego, and the environment in Southern California is quite a bit different than most of the rest of the U.S., and I think it's sort of the Kaiser effect. So I'm in a hospital-owned organization, and it's also has a foundation that has a large provider group, and then we have an affiliated provider group. So that's most of our network. We do have some other hospitals and providers involved, but 90% of our, it's a gatekeeper model, 90% of the PCPs are affiliated with those two PMGs, and we pay them on global capitation on the physician side and on the hospital side, and that's a prospective payment, and in the risk adjustment world, both for individual and for small group EHB plans, our arrangement with them when 2014 came around was, or was going to be coming around, was, hey, they say, okay, you're going to pay us prospective capitation. What if we get sick or risk on average, and then you get all this risk adjustment revenue, and, you know, you reap all the benefits of it, and then, you know, we're the ones that actually incurred the worse than expected morbidity. So the arrangement was made that we would use an external actuarial consultant to sort of parse up how that risk adjustment, both on the positive or the negative side, and the reinsurance on the individual market, between us, the hospital system, and the main PMGs. Now, the ones that contract with us, we didn't include them, but the ones that are, like, in our family, so to speak, that's what we've been doing. And I've been trying to ask people, because when I found out, because I've never been to a Health Plan Alliance meeting before, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of integrated delivery systems here. I kind of had the mindset that, oh, most of them are probably capitated. Well, as I've been talking, it seems they aren't. One of the tasks that I've been, you know, so when I was asked what my hour would be for consulting, one half of it was finding out what how you share risk adjustment, if you do, with your providers, what methodology you use, because what we're seeing is when there's a receipt, they're very happy to take it, even though they're our family.
That's
but
how
when there's
it
a payment,
yeah.
It's like, well, wait a minute, my people are really sick, and then we try showing the data, and our independent valuation of the data is consistent generally with the risk adjustment payment. So, but it's still a hard thing because they've already cashed that check on those capitation payments.
Yeah.
And they're like thinking, oh, the year's done. Now we come back in August of the following year and say, oh, yeah, guess what? Those people are actually not as sick as you thought they were. And it's been difficult. And we've been trying to get better at having that conversation. But my supervisor, CFO, has tasked me with coming here, like, find out what other integrated delivery systems are doing. And it seems like from the few people I have talked to, they aren't really doing risk adjustment sharing with the entities. But
yeah, it sounds like you're kind of ahead of the game, so that's good, but it doesn't help you know, when you go back to your doctor to CFO. But I, you know, it's funny because I think when you talk risk sharing with hospital systems, not your own, typically there's two problems. One is agreeing on any kind of risk adjustment model because everybody thinks you're trying to rip them off because this is healthcare. And the other is hospitals are always, or provider systems, whatever, are always thinking, I want a deal in which I can be no worse off than my current deal and potentially better off. And we all know that's not how RA works in the exchange model. So it's a challenge.
Yeah, one other comment to yours. We do have plans who capitate their systems, but then it breaks down when you get to the medical group. They get a capitation rate, but then the individual physician is often still working on work RVUs. So even though there's a capitation, a transference of risk, it doesn't align all the way down to the individual physician level.
That's a good point. So the PMG that's directly tied to the foundation of our parent company, those physicians and are actually salaried employees. So they don't have really, it's sort of just like, okay, this is part of my job, and the executive team wants us to do this. I don't totally understand the one that's affiliated because it's a looser organization. I don't understand how they're reimbursing their providers because they're not employees. Oh, you know what we're doing. I'm saying it in my words, like, yeah. Well, I'm saying I don't even know what we're doing. So I don't know how they reimburse their providers on that side, but good. Thanks.
Oh, thanks. That was helpful. This is great. I'm outsourcing the presentation. I can do 2 hours. This, I'm still distracted by that animation. But that's where everybody's goes there first, right? Everybody goes to the complex solutions first. I guess the point is, and we'll see this again somewhere else, is, you know, the dream sounds wonderful, but sometimes it's better to start with the simple. You know, let's focus on what can we affect and not so much on what would be perfect. And, you know, risk sharing with providers would be perfect, but it has so far proved very elusive. So, you know, what maybe should we focus on? I think execution. There's a lot of talk about risk scores seem to be improving through time. Increasing through time. Are populations getting sicker? Is a different kind of person enrolling on the exchanges? Maybe. It might also be true that we're just getting better at executing the process of realizing codes. We might just be getting better at loading edge servers, things like that. Kind of like, you know, the learning curve. First time you do something, it takes you an hour. Second time, 45 minutes. I think there might be some of that going on as well. So let's just keep our mind open. But if that's true, then one thing to keep in mind is your relative performance on risk adjustment might also be a function of how fast you're coming up that learning curve. So don't just get good at it. Get good at it faster than the competition, and that's another relative advantage. So in making this deck, I thought, well, you know, I've got to offer something, right? So I came up with this concept of value levers, and I found this little thing that turns out to be animated. And I'll include really these discussion points throughout the presentation, and they're really meant to be discussion points. These are things that I think offer value. I could be wrong. I almost guarantee I'm going to be wrong about some of them. And there you are. Okay. You let me know. Kristen picks on me. I pick on you. I don't know who you pick on. I don't care. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. You broke the rule. Never let Kristen behind you. So targeted reduction in cost share for proper management of certain HCCs. Okay. So what's that mean? That means I want to have a diabetic plan, right? So I'm going to give away test strips for free. Or massively cut the cost share on test strips. You know, maybe give, you know, find what are the services associated with proper management of diabetes? And I'm going to offer those at an extreme discount. I'm going to wrap them in a sort of a plan and sell it as the diabetic plan. They're doing this. Other plans are doing this. So that's another thing where your mind goes. Is there value in that? You know, if I can competitively manage, you know, that chronic illness cheaper than what I receive in risk adjustment. I think that's very out there. That's very alive. And Wakely gave you a list of HCCs that they think are cheaper than what you receive in risk adjustment. You know, we do that at Community Health Options. We have something that we call Chronic Illness Support Plan. And, you know, Jen could probably tell you much more about it than me, but we do offer reduced cost share for a couple things: diabetes, asthma, COPD, and we always forget the last one, hypertension. Yeah. And you know, we've always done it, so I really can't tell you how much has it helped us. But at the end of this presentation, I'm going to put our numbers up on the board, and we can decide together. So there really is a case study to this. So we're a believer in it. You know, we have received some money under risk adjustment in 2015 for our individual market. Was that a contributing factor? Hard to tell because we've always done it. Is anybody else doing something similar? I'm just curious. Any other health plans? No? Okay. All right. Well, I'm kind of surprised, but it's been received very well in the market, you know, and it has gotten us some enrollment. But I like to move on to execution things, diagnosis, code capture. So we all do, there's some of the things that everybody does, and there's vendors here that will talk you through it, sell you the services. They're very good. We use them, and you should too. And the most obvious, I think, are these what I call correlation models, right? These are the models that would tell you, go out and try to predict members that are inappropriately coded, you know, undercoded. And principally, I think they do three things. You know, they look at drug spend, they look at prior year conditions, and they look at correlated conditions, right? And I think those are the basics, and everybody should have them in their arsenal. If you don't, get them, you know, but I bet you do. There's some more exotic correlation models out there that vendors have tried to sell us, and we've said no for a couple of reasons. Some require your members to sign waivers and information releases and things like that. I don't think that would go over well. And we're a co-op, which means our members actually run the plan, vote on the board of directors, things like that. So it's very difficult for us to go out and ask our members to do things like that. Generally, I think people distrust health insurance providers. I'm sorry. You know, they do. I think we're up there with used car salesmen and politicians. But and another one I've heard is not looking at credit scores, but looking at consumer spend on credit cards and Amazon.com accounts and things like that. Once again, would probably really great data, but would require waivers, and it's really freaky to get that so far into your members' lives. So, you know, I'm not aware of anybody that's actually done that, but I've heard them discussed. But I think the next two bullets are things that aren't given as much attention, but I think also can be just as powerful. So build a database and a tight relationship with providers so that when you get the results of the first bullet and your vendor says, here's a list of 150 members that probably have this condition, given the drugs that they're buying, given the other conditions they have, and given, you know, previous year's histories, they probably have these conditions, but they're not supported anywhere in this year's codes. So you need to reach out to somebody. And that sounds simple, right? You know, pick up the phone, call a member, call a provider. But is anybody here working with member outreach or provider outreach around trying to close these gaps? Is it easy? Is it hard? Does it take a long time? Or is it?
Get the person to the doctor.
Exactly. Rudy, what do you think?
And we also have a Medicaid rebilling program. Okay. And I think the chronic condition review program has been successful. And we just started getting participation in the Medicaid rebilling.
How do you reach out and close that loop? You know, how do you reach out to the provider or the member? You know, if it's more than just a simple chart review, you know, if you actually have to get a member back
we actually give them feedback on some of the results, the coding results. We try to make sure that when we give feedback to the provider, that we're not just talking to clinicians.
Yeah,
we're looking at things like the way the EHR is set up to make sure we understand how much of it is being utilized. And we also look at the billing, try to make sure a billing manager is there, as well as a medical record manager, and even registration manager. So when we propose things, it could be that the provider's doing, the clinician's doing everything you ask, but then it's getting undone after they do it.
That's exactly what I was going for, because that's a lot of experiences we've been having. It's easy to get a hold of somebody at the provider office, but sometimes it's hard to find the contact or reach the right person, you know, to make it happen. And if it's a provider that's very active in the MA space, they think that they're in for an MA chart review. They think somebody's going to pay them $25 to get a chart and tell them what to do. But it can be slightly different in this world, and very different if you, in some cases, you actually have to bring the member in for another visit, because there may not have been a visit, there may not have been a code, you know, a chart generated, you know, to upcode. So, yes, oh yeah, don't talk. Yeah.
But we had one of the challenges we had was we have a bunch of HIV patients who all just go to this free clinic that has never submitted a commercial claim in their life. And so we had to, so our usual strategy is I just like give a list to our customer service department, say, hey, call these folks. They need to go in and get their wellness visit. And we'd call them and they'd say like, yeah, I see the doctor every other month and it's free. Why are you bugging me? And so we like went to this clinic and like they had to submit the claim like five times before they got it right. They submitted a claim for one of the visits for us to be able to finally capture that code, because we were just paying for the specialty meds and getting, you know, none of the risk adjustment out of it.
We have the same situation. You're absolutely right.
You're killing me, Joe. Sorry. You're killing me. Joe!
All of that happened just because they switched billing companies. So it wasn't happening the year before, and then we had to catch it, and it's very strange. But, that was hundreds of thousands of dollars in risk adjustment. Like $300,000 was the total of what we think we're going to get back.
Yeah, it's a pretty big coefficient, right, so for that. So it's a big deal.
Just quickly. So we're doing this on the Medicare side. I'm trying to carry it over onto commercial this year. Health New England had done a pilot with a few practices about hiring and paying for care managers. And so we're actually using the care managers in the practice. We're giving them lists, prospective scheduling lists, and saying, okay, here's the top 10, top 15 patients in your practice that have the greatest score deltas. Can you proactively schedule them to be seen, get them in? And oh, by the way, while they're in, on the Medicare side, we have reports that we get out of our tool to say, here's the gaps, here's the codes, here's the HCCs that haven't been captured. So we use the care managers and then the office managers in each of the practices to actually print a paper copy of sort of the checklist and put it in the door before the patient's seen. It's not 100%. We've got some docs that just ignore it, trash it, but we are seeing some that are actually using it to drive the conversation in the visit.
Yeah, that's a good idea. We've done that too. Sometimes it's hard to get care managers to cooperate, but CEO fixes that problem real fast. So
just one last comment. We're a little behind the curve as far as the risk adjustment piece goes in the reviews. We've done all of ours retrospectively to this point. We're just now starting to actually work on chart reviews and whatnot throughout the year. But, little unique environment where we're at, but really what we've been doing is proactive provider engagement and education with specific physician groups that are seeing the highest percentage of our membership. And it's been pretty well received. And in the thought, just like anything else with prospective education, is when that issue does come up, we can go to them and it's not completely foreign to them. So we're forewarning them, basically saying, hey, we may be coming to you in March, you know, when we're doing our previous year retrospective review for supplemental, and say, hey, you got some coding issues. And then using some of the stuff from Healthscape and scorecards and different things like that, it'll help paint a bigger picture for them and hopefully tie it all together for them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good idea. I just have one thought on that, and it may not apply in your instance, but remember, the whole name of the game here is you're trying to get a better result than the other guy. You know, this is, and I view this as a game. You know, we're like gambling is a game, right? You know, because this is about money and this is about winning money. And so if you're educating the provider community on how to better code for RA, unfortunately, you're also educating the provider community that your competitors use. So you know, one thought there is in order to improve your results, you have to somehow do that on an isolated basis. So, again, this is where I think there would be an opportunity for a provider-owned, you know, plan to really, you know, focus on your providers and, you know, maybe, I don't know, but just something to be aware of. So that's probably about enough on diagnosis code capture. Enrollment status. So this is getting away from coding and more into loading. And I have a cool chart on this later. I think you guys will like it. It's usually very popular, but it brings it all together. You know, in order to get credit for a code, that member has to actually be supported as being enrolled in your plan on any given date. All right, now your payment systems are pretty good. You're thinking, oh, we would never pay a claim if somebody wasn't enrolled. Everybody's really thinking, right, don't call on me, you know, I don't know, because it happens. But not only that, but it also has to be properly reflected in the Edge server as actively enrolled. So you have to prove it there. They don't care if you have it in, you know, somewhere else. And if that enrollment status doesn't match up with the claim status when the claim was recorded, no credit. And you can miss out on some big ones here. And we came very close to missing out on some big points here in the past. So I think we dodged that bullet, but it's something to be very aware of. Don't forget to check that stuff. Which brings us into Edge data load. So claims must load to the Edge with minimum sufficient data for RA calculation. Your claims can be loaded, and you can see the dollar amount of all your claims there. But if they don't have all the other pieces of data, and I'm sorry I don't have them on the top of my head, but if all that other supporting data isn't there and consistent, then it'll get kicked out and you'll lose credit. In year one, in 2014, when you look at the plans that went with the, I think they call it the default charge or whatever, there was many plans, some with big dollar amounts, that went with the default charge simply because they weren't successful at loading the Edge. I know one plan that loaded the Edge so poorly, they would have lost so much money. They talked CMS into allowing them to just use the default charge as if they hadn't loaded at all. But the point here is you can do all this coding correctly. You can have the greatest mix of HCCs and ages, but if you don't get it properly loaded on that Edge server, it doesn't mean anything. And if you're in the MA space, this is something to be very aware of, because this is a big difference between MA and commercial ACA risk adjustment. So you probably have another team outside of your normal RA team that does that Edge load. My advice is coordinate with them all year long. You don't have to wait till the end of the year. Load it all year long. So when it gets to the April squeeze, the last few weeks before you can have this stuff done, you're working on the last few problem. I want to say problem children, that seems inappropriate or something. But you know, you're working on the last few problems and not trying to load a full year. Jen is sitting there thinking, Ed's saying that like that's what we do. But in reality, we're usually trying to load, you know, 6 months in the last couple of weeks. But, you know, it's not a function of desire. It's a function of there were other things to do.
Hey, Ed, really quick comment before you move on from that point. At our December informatics value visit, Community First hosted that value visit, and they actually brought in their IT team, and they did a live demo on how they did. We kind of called it risk adjustment on a budget. So yep. They didn't use an outside vendor help at all to do their Edge data load. Yep. And so they did a really detailed example of how you can load it, and then you can actually verify what's taken in, and then you can find the error in the code, so that way you can reload it. So we do have that case study recorded on a podcast like the one we're doing today, which is why I'm so maniac about the... Right, okay. So, and then there's also a document with a step-by-step how to, so that's available, and I'll recirculate that to the group. Just want to let you guys know that was available.
It's worth finding the person at your organization that's responsible for this and making sure they know how. Because the danger is, you know, you steward the group called the risk adjustment group, right? So people expect that you're going to be on top of it because it's in your name. Just to reiterate, all it takes is one missing data element, and you lose the whole claim. You know, there's no partial credit in risk adjustment. All right, so that's the risk adjustment premium, right? So that's the left-hand side of the equation. This whole thing, you're trying to make it bigger. You want this number to be bigger. The bigger it is, the bigger your payout. But just to go back for a second, remember the right-hand side, the minus side, the actual premium. Okay, this side, you want it to be smaller. Not stupidly smaller, you know, but you know, to the all other things equal, you want these numbers to be littler so that your risk transfer payment is bigger. There's that lever again. Oh, there's two of them now, and they're in sync, so that's good. All right. So did he just say minimize premium? I think I said it another way, but I did say that. So a couple things here. AV, so Wakely. I keep wanting to say Milliman because that's our actuary. Catch me if I do. Wakely mentioned that they run this by metallic levels, right? And so they use the default metallic. So if you have a 68% silver plan, it still gets scored at 70% here in the formula. But you want this number to be smaller. So you want more of your members generally to be in lower AV plans. And this is partly why those gold, those platinum plans, they don't score so well for you, because a platinum coefficient up there is going to be 90%. Okay, that makes this side of the equation bigger. That makes your transfer payment smaller. All other things being equal, you would rather have that member in a silver plan with the same HCC as opposed to a platinum. There's other bad reasons to have a platinum plan, but that's just one of them. Okay, this is slightly controversial because of other things in the formula. I believe in it. That's why I referenced my own presentation as proof. Yeah, it's a trick I learned. It's like most people never look. They just, you know, they get about this far and they're like, trans, blah, blah. You know, all right, so, you know, the lower you stay on the metallic spectrum, the better for HCCs for risk adjustment. Sell plans at the minimum AV within the metal levels, okay? So this is a little more wishy-washy on the risk adjustment. You know, because technically by the formula, it doesn't change whether you're at 68% within the silver spectrum or 72. However, adverse selection changes a lot if you're the richer plan. So if you're trying to isolate, you know, certain conditions, certain health conditions in a silver plan or something, you know, because you believe you can manage them better, the last thing you want to do is attract other non-risk-adjusted folks into there, because you don't, you know, they're not going to help you. So by staying on the lower end, you avoid adverse selection and you avoid attracting any risk that you didn't really want. And here I'll go into an anecdotal example real quick. Our first year, we sold three silver plans. We sold one at 68.01, something like that. Another at about 68.2. And then another like 70.5, okay? So two very close to the bottom and another two or three points up. And the most interesting thing is the CSR variance on those three plans were almost identical. So once you were subsidized, you know, heavily subsidized, they were the same. But when you looked at only the subsidized membership of those three plans, and again, the CSR got, you know, members on those three plans. And remember, their benefits were all the same at the CSR level. You found that the ones who bought the lowest plan were our best risk by far, and the ones on the highest plan were our worst risk by far within the silver. And the only thing I can think is that they were just looking at the benefits of the base level plan, and they were thinking, I'm going to buy up, you know, to a nice level of benefit, and then because I'm going to need it, and they were right. So that's anecdotal. It's just one plan, but it was it was very discernible, and I believe in adverse selection on these markets, and so I pass it along to you. So what Wakely said this with a bunch of numbers. If you listen to their presentations in their deck, they have some charts there, and they basically said it. You may not have caught it because there's a lot of numbers. So I say it a different way. Adverse selection loss is much greater than your RA gain. So whenever you offer richer premiums, you'll probably get some RA gain because you'll attract more people with higher, more costly conditions. But you'll also attract a lot of people that have more costly conditions that do not have HCCs associated with them. And that negative effect is going to be bigger than the positive effect. Another lever, avoid copay-based cost shares. Does anybody want to take a stab at why you might not want copay-based cost shares?
Because then you don't get paid out the money from the feds, right?
If
your base plan has copays, then you don't get the feds don't front you the money on cost share reduction subsidies. Well, so you should have the crappiest base plan possible, and then a very rich benefit to the individual from what they're seeing, because it doesn't matter to you.
You're absolutely correct. Do you notice how evil it makes you sound when you say it that
Seriously?
Way?
I want to sit with you guys at dinner.
That's why I like to try to get somebody else to answer that, because it makes you sound like an evil insurance executive. But it's true. This model just makes it even more true. When you pay a $5 copay, it makes you think, oh, it cost me $5 to go to the doctor. But you can engineer a deductible coinsurance plan that gets to the same place, but all people see is that first time they go to the doctor, that huge upfront payment. Once they run through their deductible, it's all the same either way. But you're going to get a lot of more upfront utilization on a copay-based plan, especially as you get farther down into the silver variants. So again, I think this is really important. It doesn't have a lot to do with risk adjustment, but I mention it because we also have had nearly identical plans, similar AV, one based heavily in copays, one heavily in deductible coinsurance, and the deductible coinsurance performed much, much better. Yeah.
I completely agree with you about trying to go at the lower end of the AV plus or minus de minimis range, which, assuming the initial policy released yesterday gets finalized, which I'm confident will, is now plus 2 minus 4%. I say that just in case anybody has product development teams that are still consulting them about how to set their 28 products. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the AV impact within the payment transfer formula. I'm not sure if I'm understanding this correctly, and perhaps you can help me better understand it, because given this is the right side of the formula, we want to minimize it.
Yep.
However, if our silver plan, for example, is 68%, we're going to have 70% built in there no matter what. So by keeping it at 68%, in a sense, we're not minimizing it. It's actually going higher. That extra 2% higher is going to be in the numerator, not the denominator. So if we look at it just from that angle alone, it seems to me that that would reduce our risk adjustment payout. So I must be seeing this in an incorrect way.
Man, look, you could be right, I could be wrong. But my understanding is the actual AV of the plan isn't going to directly, let's go back to the form. Well, it's there in the upper right. So that AV sub I, that is the metallic level. So that's going to be 0.7 no matter what. Offering a 68 AV or a 72 isn't going to directly impact that actual calculation. So if I wasn't clear on that earlier, I'm sorry. But, it won't impact that at all. But what it will do is the higher you go, the more it's going to open you up to adverse selection. And, when you increase your adverse selection, but you're not I guess my argument is when you increase the probability of adverse selection, but are not increasing your risk adjustment receivable, you've got a one-sided effect that may not be working in your favor. And that's as strongly as I can argue it. But I hear what you're saying.
Well, and I'll point out briefly, too, I completely agree the reasons to go with the lowest end of the AV. outside of risk adjustment completely overshadow any risk adjustment impact.
Yeah.
But there is another point here, and that is that a 68% AV is going to have a lower premium than a 72% AV. And as you accurately pointed out earlier, when your premium is smaller relative to the statewide average premium, it magnifies your transfer.
Yeah.
So as long as you're in a transfer receipt mode, having a lower premium by using, say, a 66% AV instead of a 72% AV is going to help your transfer.
Yeah. No. Well, you're right, but let me see. What it's going to do is it's going to lever up your transfer. So if your transfer is good, it's going to get better. If it's bad, it's going to get worse. But you're right. Yeah. No, you're right. So, you know, part of it is you know, if you're confident, then go for it. You know, if you think you've got a winning plan design and all other things, you know, being equal, it's going to make you money, go for it. So, like I said at the beginning, man, I don't have any of those actuarial letters behind my name. So this is all, you know, our observations. And Dean, man, you've had a lot of smart things to say, and you're probably right now. But, you know, my bet is I'll go with the low end of that AV spectrum every time. But, yeah, you know, it's a great conversation. All right. Sorry, I got a little lost here. I think we're right here. Okay. So, yeah, let's see. I believe in this, but, you know. Okay. So, copays may be underscored. So, we walk through that. Metallic strategies. So, if you buy into all the rest of this, you may not. You know, I don't have data. I don't have years of data to support this. I've got 2 years worth of results, 14 and 15, well, 2.5, and a lot about 16. So my advice to you guys would be on your metallic strategies for your silver plans, don't offer a silver plan greater than 68.1%. We usually target, you know, Jen, correct me if I'm wrong, we usually do about 68.01. And the reason we don't do 68.00 is I don't understand it, but sometimes there's discrepancies between what the AV tool calculates and what the plans and benefit template calculates. You can submit everything, have it come back, and what you thought was 68.00 is actually 67.999995, and you got to do everything again. And that sucked. But I think what I've seen, the first year we did this, we were the only one that offered a silver plan down at 68.0-something, and it worked out very well for us. Every successive year since then, all the competitors' silver plans have been right down here at 68.1 area. Nobody offers anything, you know, significantly higher than that anymore. So I think it's a good idea. Apparently our competitors think it's a good idea, but I don't know. Has anybody else had other experiences? Does anybody have, like, you know, I have complete respect for your value play, Dean, but does anybody else have insight on that? Has anybody got a good product in the silver at the high end of the spectrum? All right, just curious. And you may not know, right? Gold, you have to offer gold to be a QHP on the exchange, right? So if you're on the exchange, you got to do this. And here, I really, really strongly advise you to offer it as close to 78% as possible. I think in the gold spectrum, you really expose yourself to adverse selection. We had two gold plans for a while. We had one low on 78, and initially we had one up by 82. Don't ask me what we were thinking. We got clobbered on the 82, absolutely clobbered. Got rid of it. And what was happening was we were the only one that had an 82. So everybody who was looking at the richest end of the spectrum automatically went to our plan. They were looking at the richest end because they had health conditions. Now that our gold plan is right there along with everybody else's, looking as much like Anthem and Harvard Pilgrims as possible, we seem to get our fair share of that, and it's working out a lot better. Bronze, typically low HCCs, right, because it's bronze. You know, here I think it's a lot less sensitive to the AV range because, you know, if you're the adverse selection kind of person, you're looking at silver or gold. You're not looking at bronze typically. But be careful. We still stay on the low range. Anybody else have any different, you know, there's all kinds of weird bronze strategies out there. Can we pause and, yeah.
I don't really have a bronze strategy or this is all very interesting to me. I just have one point I want to make sure I understand. So you're sort of isolating in silo the left side of the equation and the right side of the equation.
Absolutely.
And I see what you're doing there. You want to maximize and minimize.
Yep.
But really is when you maximize one, you often are maximizing the other one as well. And you minimize one, you're minimizing the other. And it's sort of if you're creating a plan design that has low exposure to adverse selection, that means you're going to get lower risk scores. If you create a plan design that has higher exposure to adverse selection, you could be getting very high HCCs. And it really boils down to, I think, more about the individual conditions which are cost-effective relative to the risk scores you could get for those conditions. Not really the plan designs themselves and being on one end of the spectrum, but maybe I'm not viewing that right.
Well, you know, so that's earlier I talked about our CISP, or Chronic Illness Support Program, that does target specific conditions through lower cost shares on the services and the drugs that treat those conditions. So that's, I think that's one way to specifically target something, you know, diabetes, COPD, hypertension, and, you know, we do that. We feel it's been beneficial. But most of the rest of the stuff I'm talking about are things that are independent to that, things that, you know, possibly you can do to improve your results, partially through under RA through plan design, but partially through avoiding mistakes. So just to go back real quick, all right, I am focusing on the left hand and the right side, left side and the right side. And if you notice what I'm doing is some things are on both sides of the equation, induced demand factor, geography are on both sides of the equation. So we're kind of ignoring those because you're right. You know, if I change the induced demand factor on one side, I'm going to change it on the other. So it's kind of, you know, an actuary will say, well, there's different denominators, so it'll be slightly different. But I think the difference would be so small, it wouldn't be worth it. But the biggest thing, I think, is the PLRS is a function of the age of the member, the condition they have, and the severity they have. That's on the left side. On the right side, that's replaced basically by your age factor. So, and the HCC component for age that goes into PLRS ranges from 0.2 to 0.7. Your age factor ranges from 0.65 to 3. So, you know, there are things to be aware of. You know, there are. If the average age of your plan goes up, you know, by, I don't know, 5 years, the left-hand side of the equation might go up by 0.04, and the right-hand side of the equation might go up by 0.2. You know, so just these are things to be aware of. How it's going to factor into your plan design and your marketing, I don't know. But, you know, just be aware. I don't know. Did that help? Okay. Yeah, I'm right there with you, man. I don't necessarily love standing up here in front of everybody and sharing stuff that's, you know, probably has flaws in it. But this is the best I have, and at the end of this discussion, man, it's just going to be better, you know. So I get a lot out of it. I hope you guys do too. What?
Thank you, Wesley. See Joe, see how he did that.
I just had a question. So on the right, on the AV that's used in the right side of the equation, for the CSR variance, does that use the AV of the base or the variant?
I'm sorry. The AV is the metallic.
Okay. So it's just 70, 80, 90.
The AV is the metallic. It's 70, 80, 90, okay. You know, 60, 70, 80, 90. I think it's 58 for the catastrophic, but that's insignificant. The ARF, they call it the actuarial rating factor, but in reality, it's just the age factor from the rating curve. Yeah. All right. Okay. So, and platinum, I will echo what Wakely said. Just say no to platinum. Don't do it. You'll get killed. I know that. Yeah, please. Wakely?
No.
That's what I heard.
No, I wrote down that he said...
I wrote down what okay. he, because I thought it was weird that he had said, well, some plans will say, you know, just stay out of platinum. But what I heard, maybe I was just making it up and dreaming or something.
No,
but,
no, you're probably paying better attention than I was.
Was that, you know, what's the point of getting out of platinum? Because those members are going to choose your gold, or those members are going to choose something else.
You're right. And I can answer that. So you're right. So remember, I mean, you've got a risk pool. You've got a community risk pool. And we all rate to the community risk pool. So those members are going to be in the pool. You know, like you can push them off this plan to that plan. And if you're the only plan in the market, you're right. What's it matter? But okay. So I think his point was probably, and somebody else jump in here because I clearly maybe wasn't paying attention. But, you know, if you certainly don't want to be the highest platinum or the only platinum, I would just get out of it. I would get out of it. You're not required to offer a platinum, so why open yourself up to that? You're required to offer a silver and a gold. See, I wouldn't offer the gold if I didn't have to be be on the exchange. So, I mean, but in the spirit of minimizing your adverse selection, and much of this has all been, in my opinion, is about minimizing that adverse selection, I would offer the thinnest gold plan you have to, and I wouldn't play with anything higher than that. I think that's how I look at it. Yeah. Yeah.
No. When I heard him say that, I was like, okay, well, we use Milliman too, and we got out of it. We decided not to do platinum this year. We just have the gold because we have to. So when he said that, I was just like, oh, well, why did we get out of it?
Yeah.
Because I'm not part of those conversations. So I just had
moved down. Does anybody here still offer a platinum? And after, okay, I mean, so... Why do you guys can you tell me, like, why, how am I wrong?
So what the Wakely got, and this is so, like, you're standing up here giving a talk. I gave the same talk last year or something similar, where it was basically like, look, we need to focus on the profitable conditions, blah blah blah, and like three conditions, and one of those ended up being way wrong, and two were right, and all that stuff. The platinum thing is still to be determined, right? Because we just started it this year, but what we realized last year is, because of the structure of our plan, we are going to have a broader network because the physicians that own us are not in the network of our competitor plans. So we are already going to receive that membership, and we had like 84% of the gold market. Yeah. Additionally, Blue Cross Blue Shield, because they can file a multi-state plan, they file their gold in the multi-state, and they don't have to abide by the same differentials that everyone else does.
Yeah.
So the problem that we came up when we started trying to rate this is, I think, what's this guy's name from Wakely?
Karan?
Yeah, Karan. Karan. Yeah, so when Karan was talking about all that stuff, the problem is actuaries say they only have a certain amount of play in between the differential between platinum and gold, and you want that differential to be as high as humanly possible because otherwise your gold people aren't going to trade up and maintain profitability because the premium's not going to be high enough.
Okay.
That makes sense.
I that's not how I roll. But man, you could be right. I have zero intention to stand up here and say this is the right way to do it. Sharing what we've done and why we're doing it.
But I think his point was gold is losing, right? You just may lose less on those members that convert from gold to platinum because of the risk adjustment differential that you're given on a platinum plan. And you've got the same member, right? So if I'm already going to have all the gold membership, they may as well be platinum.
On a platinum, if you go from gold to platinum, that AV on the right-hand side goes from a 0.8 to a 0.9.
Right, but at the same time, your risk adjustment factor goes up. I mean, you get credit for it being a platinum plan.
The induced factor goes up from...
The multiplier factor goes up.
Goes up from what, point, like 0.08 to 0.12 or something? So, I mean, one thing goes up by 0.04 and the other thing goes up by 0.... I don't know.
Fairly substantially. I don't remember what the exact number is.
The PLRS and some of the individual conditions...
PLRS and some of the individual conditions also goes up enough on the platinum that, you know, that it might work out depending on what HCC they're hitting. And it depends on, you know, if we end up with a lot of sick folks who are not hitting on HCCs, it's going to be very sad. But if they're hitting into HCCs and it's the right ones, you know, I guess we'll give a presentation next year and tell you And I think it's, you've got to be in a market like ours where we are going to pick up most of the gold membership anyway. If otherwise you're just adversely selecting yourself and it's bad. Like, we're already adversely selected, so this was an attempt to try to do something with those folks.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't take that bet, but I lose a lot of bets. So I've won some bets too, but we won't talk about those. Anyway, so that's, you know, that's my take on it. So that's the two sides of the equation, you know, the sector from my mind. There's some more exotic stuff that I haven't put up here because. Yeah, exactly. No, well, there's things. So I'll touch on some of them. So let's say you want to target. Let's pick on diabetics again. You want to target diabetics. So you do it on a silver plan on exchange, and you offer test strips for free. Okay. So if I offer test strips for free at the base level, I'm giving that away, and I have to give it away at the 73, 87, and 94% variant. Okay. I've just done something. I get reconciled on the CSR based on the difference between what I pay out on the variant and what I pay out on the base level, right? So anything I give away at the base level, I'm going to receive no CSR benefit on that for any of the CSRs. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the guys in the back that keep me honest on everything. Does that make sense? Yep. So, yeah. Okay. All right. So we'll skip that, maybe handle it at the bar. But the point is, when it gets into CSR reconciliation, you get credit for the difference between what you pay at the base and the lower levels, you know, or the higher payouts, you know, on the CSRs, and the difference in the cost share. So be careful before you give anything away on the base level to CSR on exchange. Because you'll take it in the pants in the CSR reconciliation. Is it making sense now? Yeah. So, and again, how do I know this? Experience. I took it in the pants. Yeah. Some things I feel very strongly about, and that's because I've personally lost the money. There's no, the winning a bet teaches you a little, losing a bet teaches you a lot. So
I have a question.
Yeah.
Really basic. So the model you just gave, or the example you just gave with the test strips.
Yeah.
Is that solely for member attraction to that plan, or is there
yes.
some other benefit?
So,
well, I shouldn't say benefit.
No. It's a good
is there some other reason to increase compliance, too, so that they're going into the doctor and getting scripts and getting that visit on record? Is there more to it than just member attraction?
If my boss, the CEO, were standing here, he would give you a 5-minute speech about it's the right thing to do. It's going to improve the population health in Maine, and you know the birds will sing better and the butterflies will, you know. But I'm going to sit here and answer the question like you just answered it. So hey, isn't it great when both those worlds come together for the same glorious purpose? Yeah. I love my boss, Jen. This is shit. This is recording.
Yeah. But Ed,
okay.
Can I make one point? And it's okay. Just from the conversation that you and I have had, because I think it is valuable to this, yeah. That it was intentional, right? Like that there were certain chronic conditions that
yes.
the state of Maine set out, and that's why you guys picked diabetes,
oh,
right?
The state of Maine did not do that. We studied the most prevalent chronic conditions
okay.
in the state of Maine and then chose those.
Okay.
So yeah, there was, and I got to tell you, that was done before I showed up. It was not done with RA in mind at all, but it just coincidentally has turned out well under RA. Just full disclosure, right? I don't want to sit here and tell you that I had this brilliant plan.
Well, it was pretty cool. That's what
yeah,
I was
asking. Yeah, I know. But no, you're, yeah.
Sorry. The more you keep talking, the more I have to ask more questions.
I know you think I'd learn. Yeah.
Well, so is that applicable to off the exchange type plan like mine?
Well, so here's
because I don't know how it all works into the calculation when you take out subsidy and
RA works the same, but you don't have cost share reduction off the exchange, so you don't have to worry about that CSR effect off the exchange. You know,
it would be beneficial. For risk adjustment, then
yeah,
for
absolutely,
and plus it would show a healthier benefit to the membership, potential membership against our competition.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I think it's helped us. But in a minute, I'll throw our numbers up there in
your
sure. side. All right. So Wakely didn't show you this slide, right? and little doubt why, because who the hell knows what's going on there. So I just want to make one. Yeah, smart people already talked about this yesterday. Or they didn't have this, but they talked a lot about IVA and RADV. I don't need to cover it here. But the only thing is IVA, this works a little differently in the MA space versus the commercial space. Because in the commercial space, we don't sell MA. I've worked in it before. It's been a while. But in the commercial space, you're going to get penalized if your error rate deviates significantly from the mean error rate in your market. So if you're more wronger than everybody else, you get penalized. You don't get rewarded if it's way on the positive side. I guess you can mess up the curve a little bit. But so here it's kind of weird. Like you're responsible for every claim that gets submitted to be paid by you goes on the Edge server. Every one of those could be audited against a chart sitting at the provider's office. You're responsible for that. You don't get to select certain ones that justify an HCC and only submit those. Every single one. And when you think about that, it's a little mind-boggling. Like, my God, how can I ensure the quality of all of those charts out there? And kind of the good news is you don't. You just have to be about as accurate as everybody else. And how's that going to play out? We don't know yet. It sounds good in theory, but I don't know. It's a little scary, because let's face it, we can't really affect the quality of the charting of the entire provider community in the state of Maine, But the good news is if our members are getting treated at pretty much the same places as our competitors, then it should all come out in the wash. I don't know. I don't believe it when I say it, but that's a theory. So what are we doing? This isn't a value lever, right? So that's why I have that X there. You can only lose money here. So I think the thing is you have to watch it. You have to have your code audit teams, sampling things, throughout the year. You have to, be communicating with providers. I would say, and we're still in our infancy here, when I hear you guys talk about your risk adjustment code teams, I get in a cold sweat because, Jen will tell you, we're only starting that on the RA space. So, I'm probably not the most qualified to talk about this, to be honest with you. But, we're just going to watch it and try to be competitive and hope to hell we don't lose too bad here. Other value levers. Payment transfer calculator for each plan rating area combination. All right, so if you've got a good plan and you're receiving RA in areas 1, 2, and 4 and paying it out in area 3, maybe you just don't offer an area 3 next year, Sounds kind of cutthroat, but risk adjustment's kind of cutthroat. So something to keep in mind, because it's differentiated between geographical markets, don't forget to look at that. I don't know why you would have one result in one market and another in another, but, it happens. So just be aware. And we already talked about this, state average premium. Somebody read ahead. This levers, and Wakely did mention this, right? So if your average premium is less than if your premium is less than the state average premium, you're levered higher. If you pay out, you're going to pay out more. If you receive, you're going to receive more. I knew a plan that paid out 74% of their premium in 2014, partly because their risk score was low, but also because their premium was very low relative to the state average. And somebody else might know this plan too. And, good thing they didn't have many members enrolled, and that's probably the only reason they survived. Converse is also true, and Karan covered that. So if your premium is higher than the state average, it'll mute the whole effect. And finally, I'm certain of, and I'll prove it to you in a minute. RA is an investment. I am convinced that it takes longer than one plan year to fully code new membership. So, I mean, if you enroll one guy and you focus on that one guy or lady or whatever, sure, you can fully code them. But if you enroll 5,000 new members on average, it's going to take longer than 12 months to ensure they all get seen and all get fully coded for whatever conditions that they have. I say 24 months. Don't have the data to back it up. It's just a gut. Somebody else might think 18 or 36. But it does take time. So this tells me that the first year, you have not achieved the full coding potential of a member, and you're not going to receive what you should under risk adjustment. So you probably want retention to be part of your RA strategy. The logic is simple. You know, if it takes a while, and this carries, I know this is in the MA space as well. You know, if it takes a while, you know, to fully code them, you want to hold on to them so that you can realize the full potential in successive years. So this gets to the part that people enjoy. Okay. This looks fun, right? It's like a big chart with flow chart and lines and stuff like that. So Karan said that, you know, when you start looking at RA, I think it was Karan, so correct me, but he said when you start looking at RA, you realize that it touches every part of your process in the health plan. Like every system is affected by RA. And I absolutely agree with that. I think, you know, we've talked through a lot of stuff, and what I've done is, you know, big picture thought about, well, how does it flow through the year? And how do some of these major activities impact, or could they potentially impact your RA transfer? And then I limited it to a symmetrical number of boxes so it looked good on the screen. But the you know, benefits design, we talked about that. Flows in the co-share design, developing your rates, you know, targeting age factors. Don't forget when you submit your rates and fill out the URRT. Does everybody here work with a URRT? Does anybody? Okay. So it's a form that has a lot of very specific data on it that you submit as part of your rate submission to CMS. And a lot of the data they pull for RA and other purposes is pulled directly off that form. Your state might approve your rates and say you're good to go because they don't care what's on that URRT. A good state will care, but let's say your regulator doesn't, you know, doesn't cooperate with the ACA for whatever reason, that form will dictate much of what you receive at the end of the year. And then we get into enrollment validation, claims payment, edge server. It's very cyclical. You know, when you load that stuff, you want to make sure that everything ties out. And who can guess why I put the risk adjustment calculation in a black box? Because to me, it feels like a black box. I don't think anybody's exactly solved for that thing. So I was joking. I forget whose idea this was. At lunch, we were telling jokes at the table, and we're saying that there should be another factor on the right hand of that, somewhere in that equation called W sub U. I call that the Wu factor for Jeff Wu, because when they actually perform this calculation in his office, I don't think anybody knows exactly what goes on. I think it's loosely based in the model, but hey, just personal opinion. So then your risk adjustment report is issued in June. Issuers pay in if you owe. And once everybody pays in, issuers that receive get the money back out. And then your results of your IVA and RADV will eventually come due. And in future years, they will affect what you, you know, if you're an outlier in terms of error rate, they'll affect what you receive. So you know, the idea here is you got to have, you know, you have to have this risk adjustment in mind as you go through the whole process. It's got to be part of your cadence. And as an RA manager, you have to be coordinating and communicating with the folks that run all of these different processes so they understand. And this chart is one that I like. I came up with this little saying. I thought it sounded really good. I usually get to either people are like, "Oh, well, I'm going to write that down," or like, "Oh, that's so pathetic." So again, I'm putting it out there. Code them, load them, audit, and hold them. So what I've tried to do is everything we've talked about, put it into one little, you know, it's not a mnemonic, I guess. I don't know, a couple words, but code them. he didn't practice this at all. Yeah. You know, educate your providers. We talked about that. Just be careful. If you educate the entire state how to do it right, you haven't helped yourself at all. You've helped CMS, maybe. Consider rejecting claims that contain errors inconsistent with complete code capture. Follow the laws of your state. You know, but the best way to ensure that claims are submitted with full diagnosis information that supports the claims data is, you know, maybe you audit a few there at that point and reject them if they don't work. Use correlation models. We talked about that. Engage members and providers at appropriate times. I think others have mentioned this. If you start too early, you know, guess what? Man, they were probably going to go to the doctor next month. So what's the point? If you start too late, you know, you lose the opportunity because there's not enough time left in the year to correct the miscoding. Load them. This is the Edge server. Load the stuff all year round. Trust me, we've learned. You know, it's a lot can happen in April. Ensure it's all complete. Check for enrollment. I can't say that enough. Keep up with the Edge requirements, deadlines, and command runs. There's all these mysterious command runs that happen throughout the year. Some of them don't matter. Some of them are critically important. Has anybody cracked that code? Because I haven't. All I know is I get nasty grams from CMS in my inbox all the time saying, you know, you're in violation. And I'm like, oh my God. You know, trying to make light of it. It's deadly serious, but, you know, just trying to make light. And keep loading and checking and validating until 100% of your claims are in or you run out of time. We typically run out of time. We're usually 90, high 90s, you know, but I don't think we've ever had 100% in. The point I'd make here is under RA, you always have something to work on. And just choose wisely, try to work on the thing that gets you the most bang for the buck. Audit, IVA and RADV, don't forget about it. Not really a value lever, but you can potentially lose money here. Although, you know, that hasn't been around long enough to really see how big of a threat it is. And hold them. We talked about retention. It takes, you know, a while to get somebody fully coded, to get your whole population fully coded. So there's value in retention, and retention should be part of your RA strategy. Do you want to get really cutthroat? Do you really want to like look and say, well, I want to retain these conditions, you know, more than those. So I'm going to outreach to these guys even more than those guys. You can be careful of, you know, your regulatory environment and in your state and things like that. We're a member-led plan. I don't think we would ever go there. But if you're really looking to get cutthroat, you might focus on retaining certain members that you know have real value to you, more so than you would focus on others. So that's it. Code them, load them, auto hold them. All right, so what happened to Maine? All right, the good, the bad, the ugly. I was up front from the start, man. This is just what happened. And there's some good here, there's some bad here. I'm probably right about stuff, other stuff way off base. So 2014 to 2015 on the individual market. 2014, we paid in $927,000 and we received $2,739,000 in 2015. So net-net, we improved by about $3.7 million in that year. I can tell you that our plan design stayed pretty much the same. We enrolled a lot more. So I would attribute the bulk of that increase to execution. We learned quite a bit. I think we did. We didn't get clobbered here. You know, this was off premiums of 200 and something million. So these could have been a lot worse, certainly. This was, you know, less than 1% of our premium for our plans. So that's not a bad result. But, we could have done better. And for 2015, we got a lot, not really that much better at code capture. We got a lot better at loading the Edge server compliantly. So, you know, focusing a little more on loading the Edge server was worth $3.7 million to us. Very, very real. Let's see. Mega health plans. These jokers. How did they get $57,000? They had, they sold high deductible health plans in the state of Maine pre-ACA. And when they saw the risk adjustment coming under the ACA, they created a off exchange bronze plan. And they went to the 8 of their members and said, you belong in this off-exchange bronze plan. We'll take care of you. I mean, I don't know what they actually said, but I assume that's what they said. Because each one of those guys had big health care conditions. So every one of them received under the risk adjustment. Okay, 57, that could have been worse. It's not that bad. But my point is, this thing is 100% gameable. And there's those out there that game it. I was only good for 1 year. They couldn't do it in the future, but they were able to pull it off for 1 year. Small group, how did we do? It doesn't look as pretty in small group, does it? The first year we received $98,000. Second year we paid in $3.8 million. And there's actually, we knew this was going to happen. We didn't know the exact amount. But in the state of Maine, like a lot of other states, there was a massive renewal in December of 2013 in the group market. Because you know, those who've been around, I see a couple heads shaking. No, there's a lot of people very afraid of ACA in the group business. They didn't want to give up their plans. They were just, you know, so there's a massive amount of renewal in small group 1 month early in December of 2013, so that these guys could get another year without having to worry about the Obamacare exchanges. That came due, and we had a big chunk of that in December of 2015. Came due, and a lot we were doing well. We had good rates. We had good plans. We enrolled a very large portion of our group membership in December of 2015. Under the rules at the time, if you had them at the end of the year, they were scored as if you had them the entire year. We had those members only for 1 month, which gave us almost no chance to code them correctly. So they all came in, and their HECs were rated just by their age, and we got something handed to us. We knew in principle it was going to happen. I think we underestimated exactly the magnitude of the hit. Those rules have since changed. Now it's done on a monthly basis, as Wakely talked about. So you know, that would not happen again. But you know, but that's another good point. The rules of this stuff change all the time, and you got to stay ahead of them. HEC coefficients change. Other rules change. You got to stick with the game. You got to stay current. So that's the reality. You know, again, I told you when I started, I'm not a genius, right? You know, so sometimes we get lucky, sometimes not. But those are the actual results. The one good part about it is Anthem had to pay in $4 million in year two. So I like the fact that I'm taking money from our biggest competitor. That just makes me feel warm and fuzzy inside. That's okay. So what's happening when we look ahead to 2016, what I think is going to happen to us? I don't think we're going to get clobbered on small group again, because, you know, we learned we're not doing that again. We've had most of those members all year long in 2016. I think we've more fully coded them. I think that'll give us an advantage. And individual, I'm looking forward to continued positive results. So I'm privately optimistic about 2016. However, there's dark trends out there. Our membership was frozen on the exchange in 2016 because of limited capital, because we're a co-op and we can't really access the capital markets. That was good for us in terms of risk, you know, because we were not exposed to SEPs. So good. SEPs are bad, in my opinion. I think, does anybody disagree with SEPs are bad? Okay, good. I thought I was safe in saying that. The problem is those SEPs being, you know, they come with conditions. So, you know, they're bad for your claims, but they push up your PLRS. So I don't know what's going to win out in 2016. I think there's some positives, some negatives. I'm on the edge of my seat. But I couldn't control that. It just kind of happened. And last note, again, just some facts and figures here that I pulled directly out of the transfer reports issued by CMS. It didn't change much in 2014 or 2015. You see a large percentage of average premiums in QHP plans are paid out through risk adjustment at the end of the year. This is a serious business. Everybody wants to know what the number is all throughout the year, and Wakely does an excellent job. But you saw their ranges in accuracy. They're pretty big. You know, I mean, they're the best you can do, but still it's hard to know for sure. And also, just for fun, I put the national average monthly premium over there. You see it didn't increase much from 14 to 15. The 16 data isn't out yet, but I predict that premium went up a lot more in 16 and maybe in future years. So that's it. That's where our head was at when we did what we did. It's a little bit of humor thrown in, because this stuff would just be too depressing if I didn't. And it's our actual results. So again, you know, it just is what it is. Thank you for engaging so productively in all the feedback. I really value it. There's some folks here who I think have really helped me understand this better, and I appreciate it. And I'm going to shut up and take your abuse. Thank you.
If nobody else volunteers, I'll buy you a drink tonight.
Awesome. Okay.
All right. I feel like a lot of people are going to
volunteer. Yeah.
All right. Questions for Ed. Right behind you.
So on your slide with your boxes for your map, Just a suggestion that we're doing this year is I hired two intake coordinators that are doing paper HRAs, so outbound telephonic calls, because, you know, we don't get to screen our members before they become our members.
Yep.
We're trying to hit them in the first couple months of the year. So like you said, you know, get 1 year, you're not going to know what your members are.
Yep.
So we're trying to stratify that. We have some targeting logic built into the responses to the HRA and everything. And then the second piece that I just wanted to plug in there that I haven't done yet, but I heard from an actuary on your next slide, your CODEM, your second bullet, the consider rejecting claims.
Yep.
Looking at it the opposite way, look at your rejected claims to see if that's the only claim that holds the HCC code for the year, to see if you're missing out on something that you could fix for your plan.
Those are great points. I would love to hear the results on the HRA folks. And I operate under the theory that when we reject claims, they're not just going to go away. They're going to come, you know, they're going to fix them and come back. If they do just go away, maybe I'm okay with that too. But yeah, thank you.
Can you say that last part?
Sure. So let's say that a member had a claim and it's the only claim in the calendar year that holds your HCC. And it was rejected for some crazy non-related reason, and the doctor's office just is not getting back to you to, you know, they don't want to fix it. So you never hear back from that. You lose it for the year. So
rejected at the plan level? Like,
no. So your provider's just, you know, just whatever. Okay. You know, I'm not going to respond to you. Or maybe even not coaching them, but maybe even saying, hey, we have this rejected claim. We'd really like to talk to you about your documentation, which also supports XYZ, and I see that you missed that.
Yeah.
Just, you know, just maybe looking at it to see if there's something missing in
there. It's a great, I mean, those are great ideas. I'm sorry if I seem dismissive. Those are awesome ideas. I will add those. Thank you.
One of the things that we did as well was looking at claims that are on non-allowable CPTs where you've got that HCC on there, but you haven't gotten it on an E&M visit, so it goes in the Edge server but doesn't count for the RA, and then making sure that that person gets into an allowable visit.
Yeah.
Can we have a table microphone? Just like leave one. Yeah, it's big. First, can you send out your HRA survey that you guys are doing? Okay, that would be super cool. Thank you. There was one thing that on your slide.
Oh, this is so awesome. I love this part. No, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay,
just,
so.
Just focus on the animation, Joe.
Right. So go back one more, two more. Oh, minimize premium. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So the minimize premium slide.
Yeah.
All right. Have you actually been able to quantify the statement that adverse selection is greater than risk adjustment gain? That's one question. The second question is, when you're looking at, so when you say that you don't get as much, right, like you should minimize premium, I actually usually think of that in exactly the opposite way, which is since we are highly dependent on risk transfer, we want the premium to be as high as possible. So I'm worried about Centene has just come into the Atlanta market, which we don't play in at all, but they're driving down premiums, which is going to affect the amount that I get back on risk adjustment in a big way.
When I say minimize premium, I mean only, you know, as it pertains to this formula. So obviously, you know, we all want our premium to be bigger, big picture. So keep in mind that this right-hand side, that's not your actual premium. That's sort of an estimation based upon these four factors. So, yeah, it's a bit of tongue-in-cheek, yeah, because what you're really wanting to minimize is AV, ARF, IDF, and GCF. IDF and GCF are on both sides of the equation, so how much can it really matter? So I focus on the AV and the ARF. AV, you're probably pretty fixed on anyway, and so be mindful of your age. Yeah. In terms of, you know, can I quantify, you know, can I prove the adverse selection is bigger? You know, I've got 2 years of solid plan results. So can I prove it? No. I was telling you the story, the three silver plans we had, and we you know, fixed that. We fixed it real good in 2016, but we partially fixed it in 2015. And I saw drastically improved results. You know, two data points don't make a trend. But, you know, in this game, man, you got to learn, and you got to learn fast. So if you have a gut and you think you have some data to support it and you don't see how it can hurt you, I would definitely recommend trying it out.
And just to keep you honest, we have a Wakely person back in the room now.
Okay.
So the discussion you were having about platinum and why you said no to platinum and why you thought to go to it, if you could just sort of repeat that and then
okay.
React to it.
All right. So I'll try to recreate that. And I was... So where the hell was it? Okay. To me, we've never offered a platinum plan, but I know through the co-op organization, several offered the platinum plan for 1 year, and they got killed on adverse selection and dropped it the next year, and it got better. With my experience in offering two different gold plans, one at a lower AV and one at a higher AV, we experienced... a very significant amount of adverse selection within those two gold plans. You know, the one at the higher AV had significantly worse loss ratio than the lower. So my point is, and I think the way you said this, Karan, but you're here and that's awesome, is, you know, you don't want to be an outlier on the high end of generous spectrum in the platinum area. My perspective on that is, why even flirt with that? You know, so you're not required to offer a platinum plan. I wouldn't touch it, and I would ensure that the gold plan that I am required to offer on the exchange is way down at the minimum end of the spectrum. And Joe, I don't know if you want to recount.
And basically, we offered a platinum plan starting in 2017. So this is the first year that we're doing this. This is one of our kind of bigger experiments. But the reasoning was we had 84% of the gold market, right? Blue Cross Blue Shield has a multi-state plan. They can price that well above the differentials that you can price if you just place things on the marketplace. So we're always going to have the gold membership. It's never going to go anywhere else because we're the cheapest gold option. In that case, it makes more sense. Well, it made more sense to me to try and get the differential between the platinum and the gold plan as high as I could possibly get it on the premium side. But then also knowing that people who have chronic conditions that are already going to be purchasing the gold plan transfer to platinum, and then the risk adjustment formula benefits you by pumping up your results because it has higher induced demand factors on platinum, which, well, higher than gold. That was the logic that we used.
So
referee,
what's your,
buddy.
Referee.
Come on.
What's your perspective?
Thank you for recapping that. Yeah. I think... You know, so this is one of those weird markets where you both can be right and both can be wrong depending on the set of data you're looking at.
Come on,
data.
Stop selling something,
no,
man.
You gotta, no. I know I'm trying to cop out, but I'll explain myself why that is. So with the platinum, what I've noticed is if you are, you know, let's talk about the high-cost plan. So if you're a high-cost plan and the discussion that I was having about, you know, the broad network, narrow network, you could kind of summarize the discussion based on a high-cost, a high-premium plan and a low-premium plan. So if the low-premium plan in risk transfer equation is getting paid based on a market average, it's not going to receive enough. Because if its morbidity is 20% higher, then you're going to multiply that 20% by a number that does not reflect your underlying cost structure. Right? So the risk transfer falls short in that regard. So if you are the only one offering platinum, but now you're the low-cost carrier, and there are high-cost carriers in your marketplace, there can be an offsetting effect because when looking at comparing premium to bronze, for example, platinum to bronze, your market average premium is going to be between platinum and bronze, probably around silver in the individual market. So platinum is not going to get fully compensated. If it's 20% higher morbidity, it's going to get paid based on the silver premium, so it's not going to get fully compensated. However, if you're a low-cost carrier and you are in a receivable position, then you're getting more dollars into your plan overall, and now some of that effect between platinum, having a platinum plan out there, the effect that I just described is now muted. You know, there's offsetting forces. So it really depends. So if you're the high-cost carrier, yeah, it doesn't make sense for you to have a platinum. You should absolutely not. If you're the low-cost carrier, you can have a platinum, and the the disadvantage is a little bit muted. And then the other thing I'll point out, the consideration in, when we were modeling this, what we thought about was your platinum gets selected against. If your unhealthy members are going into platinum, they're going to blow through. If it's the type of members who are going to blow through their maximum out-of-pocket, then my argument that I made during my presentation, you got rid of your platinum and everybody moves to gold and everything scales down. Well, that's not really true if people are blowing through their out-of-pocket maximum, because the reduction on the cost side is not going to be 10%, the difference between the platinum and the gold actuarial value. Does that sort of make sense? So technically, on average, on a platinum plan, the plan expects to pay 90% of the claim cost and member pays 10. In a gold plan expects to pay 80% of the cost, member pays 20. So moving all of your platinum members in a perfect world from platinum to gold, the plan should see their cost go down by 10%. However, if platinum members are blowing through their out-of-pocket maximum, they're really, really expensive, then the cost-sharing differential will be minimal. You know, they're going to look more like the 99% AB. So when you move them to gold, the 99 might look like 98, 97. And the reduction in cost is going to be smaller, but then the reduction in premium is going to be big. Reduction in your risk transfer is going to be big. So you don't see the reduction in cost side. So in that case, it would make sense to have your platinum collect the great higher premiums on the platinum.
All right, there you have it.
Well, now yeah.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. I guess I would, and no, that's, thanks. I referenced your presentation a lot because I found it so helpful. So I tried to be very fair, and I'm glad you guys came back. I will make the point that the issuers that seem to be making money on 2015, you know, which is the last full year of data we had, frankly, they're selling Medicaid Plus plans. They're selling, you know, silver plans targeted at highly subsidized members. You know, Centene, Molina, they're really Medicaid issuers taking advantage of their Medicaid networks. They're going to their Medicaid networks and promising them, I will not market this to anybody except for the highly subsidized. And they're cleaning up. So, I'll just, this isn't actuarial, and I never promise to be the smartest guy in the room, but those are the guys making the money. And I guess that's my final argument for stay low in the AV spectrum and stay low within the metallic, you know, spectrum of the plans that you have. But it's just my advice. Oh, and stay narrow too. You know, broad networks are losers.